Hello everyone, welcome again to the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast. It's a bit of a shorter episode this week. There's not as much cricket going on and possibly not a lot for future episodes, but we'll find some content. And to join me to talk about the cricket we did have, which includes WCL 6 and some ICAP games, is my regular host, Andrew Nixon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
Andrew, let's start with WCL 6. It was an interesting tournament. I guess the first point to start is that one of the teams didn't manage to get there in Saudi Arabia. And in the past, I think we've kind of said that the ICC needs to do a bit more with the visas on this, but I feel like there was more than enough time for them to organise a visa, and this is really just shoddy organising on their part.
Yeah, they've known they've been playing this tournament, I think, for a year now, so it's not as if there wasn't enough time to organise a visa. But we don't quite know exactly what's gone on, whether they got visas and they were turned back at the UK border or what. So, but yeah, I think it's pretty shoddy all round, to be honest with you.
Group A included Guernsey, Suriname, Botswana, and Fiji, and it was a fairly uneven group. Guernsey was dominant through the first three games, the net run rate of plus 2.5, and Suriname, except for their loss to Guernsey, was pretty good as well.
Guernsey had a couple of players who scored centuries and just looked streets ahead of the other teams in the group. Fiji looked completely out of it, and Botswana didn't look too impressive either, apart from in their win against Fiji. Suriname played reasonably well. Obviously, they had that defeat to Guernsey, but by that time, they'd already qualified for the semi-finals.
Interesting thing, I guess, is that Suriname did eventually beat Guernsey in the final, although this match didn't really matter. One of the things about the Suriname side is they're very dependent on two players, Singh and Pathandan, for both wickets and runs.
That seems to have been the case for a while for Suriname. They always seem to be dependent on one or two players, and maybe the odd occasion another player steps up and does something. But that's probably, if they're going to progress in the World Cricket League, they need to have more players succeed on a more regular basis.
And there's a little bit of disquiet about this squad potentially, and some allegations being made that some of them may not actually be from Suriname.
Yeah, I mean, we should stress, these are very allegations and seem to be a little unfounded at the moment. The allegations are anywhere from a couple to almost the entire squad aren't actually eligible for Suriname. They may have Surinamese nationality. They may have been born in Suriname, but whether they actually meet the development criteria or not, I think, is what's in question, that they might not actually be playing club cricket in Suriname. Development criteria are relatively hard to police. Your residential and birth and passport are very actually easy to evidence, because you've got actual legal documents to show that sort of thing. Although there's even an allegation that one of the players might actually be travelling on a fake passport. So, but the development criteria, I think, is declared by the players that they meet the development criteria, and it's only on if anybody actually says, well, maybe something's not quite right here, that an actual investigation takes place. Something similar actually happened at World Cricket League Division 2 earlier in the year with Uganda. Uganda had got relegated in that tournament, so it didn't really matter. Obviously, in this case, Suriname have got promoted. They beat Vanuatu in the semi-final, and if I was Vanuatu, I'm demanding the ICC investigate these allegations, and Vanuatu went on to finish third. And if Suriname were to be kicked out and be punished, then obviously Vanuatu would be promoted in their place. Division 5 isn't scheduled until I think April, May next year, so there's plenty of time for an investigation to take place. And there's the saying, there's no smoke without fire. And I think if there's anything to these allegations, then obviously Suriname should be sanctioned in some way.
The other teams in the group were both expected Fiji to do fairly well, and it was a bit of a surprise that, although they had a couple of close losses, as well as a big loss to Guernsey, that they ended up bottom of the group in the group stages and fifth after the playoff.
Yeah, they played pretty poorly throughout the tournament, to be honest, and it's a bit of a surprise. Obviously, they pulled out of the Pacific Games last month, 2 months ago now, in order to sort of concentrate on preparation for this, and they'd been putting in a lot of effort to try and do well in this tournament. I think they'll be extremely disappointed, and obviously, they've got their under-19 team doing so well, qualifying for the under-19 World Cup, so there's obviously other players coming through, but I think in this case, the national side, just whether it was unfamiliarity with the conditions or what, I don't know, but they just didn't seem to be playing at the best.
Group B, without Saudi Arabia, is looked a bit of a weak group, and Vanuatu played pretty well to come through with the victory. Left Norway and Cayman Islands to have a single match between them to decide second, which was pretty close. But when it came to the semi-finals, neither of those two teams were really in it.
No, you're right. And the semi-finals were pretty... not the completely one-sided, but it never really looked like Norway or Vanuatu were going to win them. Obviously, Vanuatu bowled out for 140 in their semi-finals. Norway got a bit closer against Guernsey, but they only got close because of one player, and so they never really looked like winning it. So it looked like without Saudi Arabia in that group, started to look a bit weak. Saudi Arabia could probably have shut things up a bit and probably would have made the semi-finals had they taken part.
So in the end, Guernsey and Suriname went through, and be interested to see how they go in World Cricket League Division 5. And I guess good for once to see an America's team actually get promoted, given the troubles they've had.
Yeah, it's been quite some time since an America's team got promoted in the World Cricket League. I think the last one might have been 2010. I think the USA got promoted that year. I stand to be corrected on that. It's good to see the America's team get promoted, subject to any sort of challenge from Vanuatu or whoever. The region's been struggling in recent years, so I'm sure the management of the America's Development Region will be pleased to see a team finally get promoted.
And assuming the World Cricket League 6 domain remains the way it is for the next cycle, which is not necessarily the case, Vanuatu will be in that division still?
Obviously it's good that they won't have to come through the regional qualifiers again. You've managed to retain that place, so they'll be delighted with that performance, but I think they'll be disappointed in the same way that they weren't able to get promoted to Division 5. Joining us now to talk about World Cricket League Division 6 is Guernsey Cricket Board Chief Executive Mark Latter. Thanks for coming on the show, Mark.
Hello.
Start with Division 6. You're lost in the final, but I suppose job was done in terms of getting promotion.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd been far more annoyed losing to Norway in the previous game, which is really where it all mattered in terms of getting promotion to World League 5. It would have been just nice to have obviously won the trophy, but it wasn't to be.
For the team, it was a very successful tour. You had a couple of players score centuries. You'd only had maybe two or three in the World Cricket League player before. Any particular player you want to highlight?
I think Matt Stokes, whilst Ollie Newey obviously getting a ton, was excellent for different reasons. Matt is a guy that's come right through our system. All his cricket's been played here, although he was born in Scotland, which I possibly shouldn't tell them, but there you go. Mr. Brooks can pick that one up. But everything he's been through his cricket life has been here in Guernsey, and he's always shown a lot of promise. Went across to Sussex early, came back, worked on a lot of stuff, and to see him now playing the cricket he is immensely satisfying for a lot of people who've been involved in his life, and obviously Nick, who's been working with him for the last couple of 3 years. So Matt was great. Ollie is an example of somebody who works with the powers that he's got and the abilities that he's got, and he's got the most out of those. And again, a lot of that goes down to Nick Pothas.
And looking at Daniel Hooper, had a couple of really useful all-round performances from him as well.
Yeah, David.
David Hooper,
yeah. Hoops, as we call him, which makes life easier. He's always, again, he, like Ben Fairbrush, they've been on now four or five tours, where people forget they're sort of 24, 26, and they've become the sort of sticking plaster in that middle order that we used to have from the likes of Frithy, Savadon, Leprevo, etc. And they've now this sort of elder statesman with the 17-year-olds, 19-year-olds in the team. So it's good to see them now standing up and taking the wickets, scoring the runs, and looking after the younger players in the team. With an average age of 21, the younger players are young.
That was something I was going to ask about. It's been something of a transitional year for Guernsey. A lot of the older players moved out of the team and younger players coming through. Despite that, though, it's been relatively quite a successful year.
Yeah, I mean, in 50-over cricket, we've the only game we played sort of 9 meaningful games as such in forms of competition and tours away up in Newcastle. We've lost the one, which was unfortunately the final. 20-over cricket started obviously very well in Jersey with the defeat of Denmark, which was our highest ranked victory. Last two losses, we probably weren't totally in the game, but I think they were winnable with that unit. So from where we changed a couple of years ago when we got Nick in to where we are now, that transition's really worked. I think the most pleasing thing is that when we first went into this ICC journey back in 2008-09, a lot of people thought 65,000 people, you're not going to have enough players to be able to do this. And in fact, this is probably our fifth regeneration of the side. So to have been able to do that, still be successful, and with this unit, you know, back to have another 5-10 years of success, hopefully, then, you know, I think we've proved a lot of the doubters wrong, and most importantly, proved ourselves right.
Just looking at your neighbours in the English Channel there, I know you're very rarely quick to give Jersey credit, but you look at what they did in the World 2020 qualifier, does that sort of give you a bit of inspiration that you're very nearly qualified for the World 2020? Well, maybe we could do that. You beat Jersey this year, and does it give you confidence of you're looking ahead to the next 2020 qualifier cycle?
Yeah, it's difficult to read that T20 because when they qualified, I mean, we were talking to the guys from Denmark, etc., and they were saying how they hadn't won any games at that level for a couple of years, and you looked at the previous qualifying and how the European teams had done, and, you know, the victories they won, you thought maybe they were on a hiding to nothing, and what would they gain from it? But, I mean, seeing them on Sky TV was phenomenal, I think, for them, for associate cricket, and certainly in the European Union and in the Channel Islands. And I think, obviously, their performance is borne out that they deserve to be there. Whether that says the top's getting closer to the bottom, the bottom's getting closer to the top, I don't know. But it certainly gives us something to shoot for, and it makes that tournament something we would very much like to be part of. And if it stays in the same process with the media profile, then it can only be a good thing. So, yeah, more power to their elbow.
And in terms of looking ahead to next year, obviously we'll have a Division 5 tournament to play. What else is sort of in the pipeline for Guernsey?
Well, yeah, Division 5, if the structure stays the same, so at the moment we're working to that basis. That means we'd be looking for some warm-up games in April. And out of the trip to Essex, we've made some great contacts with some of the clubs there. I have to say, the Essex County cricket team and the clubs and everything else that put together the tournament there were phenomenal. So we've got that. We're looking at, obviously, our first venture into the Sussex Leagues, and we're going in there as effectively a club side, but it's effectively a Guernsey Development Plus. So we'll be looking at in the next few months to see what that schedule is going to look like and how that's going to work. Effectively, it's working on the same model as the Sussex Academy, who play in the Premier Division over there. We're starting in Division 1 of that. So we've got that. Inter-Inter, obviously, over in Jersey. And then, depending on the World Cricket League scheduling, we might look at doing something with Denmark and Italy, which is something we proposed to do a year or two ago, but it didn't quite work with our other commitments.
And in terms of sort of youth cricket, obviously we mentioned the young players coming through. Is everything sort of running pretty well as far as youth development goes in Guernsey?
Yeah, I think our development program's pretty well established, which is why we felt confident of going into this process with ICC in the first place, despite the supposed numbers going inequalities. At the junior levels, under-11s, under-13s, we play in the Sussex District system, which has helped us. It's also shown us where our shortfalls are, and we've got a bit of work to do in there. Under-15s, pretty good. Did okay in rugby, pushed Scotland close, having beaten them the previous year, beat Jersey and the Danes who came back in. 17s, 19s, a bit of a gap. Also a little bit of a gap in the ICC Europe programme there, so we're looking for sort of, you know, what we can do with those guys and where they play. And then, obviously, underneath the senior team, making sure we're keeping the guys that are slightly outside of the squad, pushing them to make sure that they're pushing the guys above them. And that's where the Sussex thing will probably be fit for us, and anything else we can find amongst the European system. Again, we need to know what that's going to be about as well before we go plowing our own furrow.
What about women's cricket?
Yeah, good. So the last couple of years we've put together a team based out of our hockey side, so we sort of picked up girls from there. That started to work together quite well. We played the French, who were using that as a warm-up prior to going off to the tournament that was in Jersey this year, and we beat them. That's given the girls a bigger appetite. So far, it's been good in the practice and the wanting to sort of learn and develop. Not so good in trying to get them into the competitive spirit, but I think that game against France has given a lot of confidence. now got Katie Watson as working as a part-time women's development officer. So she's going into the schools, girls' programs, which Hoops is obviously helping her with within his community cricket role. So that's worked well, and off the back of the discussions with Essex, we've looked at maybe taking a tour there next year. And obviously we're hopeful that Sarah Taylor and the Sussex girls will be over again for their third trip this year. So that's starting to move as well.
Just in terms of the sort of European regional tournaments, obviously it's all 2020 at the moment for senior teams. Would you like to see a reintroduction of the 50-over stuff for the national teams?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a paper out there that sort of emanated from Guernsey, which you're looking at, you know, trying to re-establish the regional tournament as a qualifying process into the World Cricket League, effectively mirroring the current T20 process, so that we can, you know, you play some regional cricket, get into some sort of Champions Trophy style format, and then look at something in a reduced World Cricket League. I mean, World Cricket League is a fantastic thing, but it can also be a bit of a, be careful what you wish for in terms of the amount of travel and the pressure it puts upon teams. Now you've got T20 out to 4 years, we've got nothing to 2019. I think there's time to look at the whole process and see what we can do. If we could save money at the top end and put that back into regional cricket, and that's got to be a good thing.
And I suppose it's always been a problem with, you know, an amateur team like Guernsey having to, if you get promoted twice, you're playing three tournaments in about 12 months, and it's actually quite difficult to get players' time of work, and you end up fielding weakened sides.
Yeah, absolutely, which could obviously, you know, questions the whole integrity of the process, and we don't want to do that, but there's reality, and you know, the guys are amateurs and they've got to get time off work. Or more so now with our team, we've got to get more school. I spent more time talking to headmasters than employers and stuff. So, you know, that's a positive thing from the development programme perspective, but it's also got to be acknowledged in the reality of what you can do. And this year, for instance, you know, if the World Cricket League's structure had been as they were proposing with the T20, and had we been as successful as Jersey might have had as well, you could have had four or five World ICC tournaments and 10, 11 weeks away from work or family, and that's just not practical.
Just going back to youth cricket as well, do you think it's a potential issue for Guernsey of players sort of moving off island to attend university and then perhaps not coming back, or is that not something really that happens?
It does happen. It's something we have to be aware of, especially where, of course, the player wasn't originally born in Guernsey, even though he may have been on the island for pretty much all his life. So we have to be careful in terms of how that works with a family base here and everything. It's good whilst they're in education. It's whether or not they come back from university to Guernsey for employment or they go back into the UK, as statistically, I think locally, it's shown that has become. But we're kind of countering that by trying to control that. So at the moment, we work with the players through their off-island education, be that sixth form or into university, make sure we know the people at university, make sure they've got a good cricket school. We've got contact then with them through the Sussex links with the coaches we've got on the ground there, so we can manage it throughout that period and also obviously ensure that when people go, they know they're a Guernsey player. And it's obviously high profile for the university system as well if they're playing international cricket, like the two guys from Lancing who were playing in the tournament just gone.
Well, just about wraps it up. Thanks for coming on the show, and good luck for next year.
Cheers, no problem.
The other significant matches that were on in the last couple of weeks was the I Cup games between, and the World Cricket League Championship matches between the Netherlands and Scotland. There's a fair bit of rain affecting them, which means that the World Cricket League Championship matches, the first was washed out and the second is going to be played after we've recorded this, but you'll have it.
Maybe.
If it dries. But we'll chat about the I Cup game. It was pretty interesting match, this one. The fairly low scoring, and the Dutch came through with the victory. It looked like Scotland was going to make a bit of a comeback in the last day or so, but they managed to hold on.
Yeah, obviously the first day was washed out. It's been pretty rainy in the Netherlands. It is actually after the end of the cricket season, so perhaps not the best time to be scheduling these games over there. You look at that Dutch first innings, they scored 210. They had Van der Merwe, obviously a very experienced player, scored 73. Nothing really else to say about that innings. Scotland, in their first innings, just looked completely out of it. They were 31 for 6 at one point. It took 46 from Taylor and 32 from Sharif, who was batting at 10, to really actually get them, so that they avoided even the follow-on. They very nearly followed on after scoring 210 after conceding 210, which had been an absolutely disastrous performance. King the ball very well for the Netherlands, who took four wickets. Then the Dutch second innings went similar way to the Scotland innings. Actually, they were 44-5 at one point, slight recovery and board up 123. And then Scotland, again, there was a early wickets, and then got back into the game. Berrington with 59, Taylor with 52. They put on about 100 for the sixth wicket. And then Boran just bowled superbly. He took four wickets for just one run in three overs and two balls, and won the game for the Dutch. And I think it's the first win in the Intercontinental Cup for 7 years. Obviously delighted to have broken that particular duck.
Yeah, it puts them in an interesting position. They obviously lost their first match to PNG, but I'm not sure it's necessarily their focus, but if they could keep winning, they've beaten now the side that I think a few people were saying was the most likely challenger to Ireland and Afghanistan. So if they can keep winning, they could press on to that final, and you never know what happens then.
No, obviously there isn't actually a final in this tournament. It's just the top of the league that actually goes through to the Test Challenge, apparently, allegedly, at some point in the future. I think given this defeat of Scotland, you'd probably make Ireland favourites now for the Intercontinental Cup, although obviously you can't rule out Afghanistan, although they've had the draw in their first match. I think we both are big fans of the Intercontinental Cup, and it's looking like it's going to be another good tournament.
In the WCL championship match that was washed out just briefly, again we saw a really low scoring start to the game. Netherlands were 5-35 when the first day was washed out, and then they managed to recover to 6-161 when the whole thing was washed out. But it's a bit of a trend, the low scoring, and again probably related to the weather.
I think we should probably highlight Peter Seeler's 68. Obviously, he's better known as a bowler, and he came in and scored 68. You put on 130 odd with Van der Merwe, obviously a very talented batsman, as we've already mentioned. So we should highlight that. Again, we're looking at another washed out World Cricket League Championship game, and it's a bit of a bugbear of mine. The tournament lasts 2.5 years. Why is there no proviso to reschedule the washed out games and play them again at a later date, next year when the weather's better or whenever? It's not as if Netherlands and Scotland are far apart from each other, and it involves a lot of travel. It's an hour and a half on a plane. So it's not as if these games couldn't be rescheduled. So it's a little unfortunate, but it seems to be the way the ICC run this tournament for some unknown reason.
Just worth highlighting too, Davey picked up 3 wickets. He picked up a number of wickets in the ICAP game as well. He's bowling pretty well, and Van der Merwe runs and wickets in both these matches. So him in particular, if he can stick around, it makes a big difference to the Dutch side.
Yeah, obviously he's got a contract at, I think, Somerset next year and the year after as well. So that could affect his availability for the Netherlands, but despite the so-called mandatory release rules that the ICC have in place. So we'll see what happens there, but he's obviously a big part of this side now, and I think that's what you'd expect from someone who's played for South Africa. Joining us now on the podcast is former vice chairman of the KNCB and part of the Cricket Europe Netherlands team, Rod Lyall. Thanks for joining us, Rod.
Thank you. Good to be here, Andrew.
Thank you. We're here to first talk about the Netherlands v Scotland games. One thing we did learn from this is that September in the Netherlands isn't particularly a good time of year to be playing cricket.
Well, sometimes it is. Last year we had a great September. It was kind of Indian summer. And this year, obviously, this particular week has been horrible. And last week wasn't great either.
We'll start with the Intercontinental Cup game. Obviously, the first day was washed out and it became a 3-day game. And a very low-scoring one at that.
Yes, that's right. All kinds of reasons, I think. It wasn't an easy pitch for batting on. But you wouldn't say, I think, that it was the pitch which was totally responsible for the low scores. There was some really good bowling, especially from the Dutch, but also from the Scots. They bowled the right lines, they bowled the right areas, they kept the pressure on the batsmen. And you'd have to say that there was some pretty feckless batting from the top six in both sides, with the notable exception of Roelof van der Merwe in the first innings and Richie Barrington in the second for the Netherlands and Scotland, respectively. For the rest, the batting was, not great.
I suppose van der Merwe's performance just shows the value of having someone with that sort of experience in the side.
Yes, although having said that, he played a wild shot in the second inning. Mm-hmm. Maybe he was looking to try and push on, but it wasn't a situation in which pushing on was the obvious manoeuvre. So, one really good innings, and he bowled well throughout as well. Apart from that, the Dutch top six really didn't distinguish itself, and you can't say much more about the Scots.
It seemed in sort of all four innings that there was a collapse and then a decent partnership that sort of got them back in track. Can you think of any reason why that might be, or is it just your bowlers were moving out of the attack and less effective bowlers coming in?
I think that was partly a factor, and I think also once the collapse had taken place, the middle order just settled down and were determined to stay there. Steph Myburgh batted well twice until he got out. I've also haven't been totally fair, I have to say, to Michael Rippon, who started well in both innings, opening for the Netherlands. So he was at least a partial exception, and he was slightly unlucky to be run out in the second innings as well. It was a dark run, but it was a very good throw that hit the stumps. The lower middle order, Rob Taylor batted really well in both innings. And some of the Dutch lower order, Peter Sailor for a while, also showed that you could bat and you could make runs. And the outstanding partnership, probably of the match, was the one on the last morning, between Barrington and Taylor, which looked almost up until lunch as if it might take the game away from the Dutch, as they had lost out to Papua New Guinea on the final day earlier in the summer.
And obviously, Netherlands eventually did win the game. I think the first win in the competition for about 7 years. Good to finally sort of get that streak off the back.
Absolutely. And it took an amazing spell from Peter Boren to do it.
Yeah, 4 wickets for 1 run in 3.2 overs.
Yes.
He doesn't bowl that well that often. He does bowl a lot, but not always as effectively as that, I suppose.
And he's been bowling less as well because of shoulder problems. But now he's had the operation. He had the operation last winter. And, this was as good a spell of bowling as I've seen him produce. I've watched him a lot because I used to score for VRA, his club side in Amsterdam as well. So I've seen an awful lot of Peter batting and bowling, and this was certainly one of the best spells I've seen him produce.
So we'll move on now to the one one-day game that actually saw some play. A similar sort of batting performance that we saw in the Intercontinental Cup, where the top five didn't really do much. They're all out in single-figure scores, and then a partnership in this case between van der Merwe and Peter Sailor sort of got them 261 for six before the rain came.
Yeah. So it's not just four-day cricket that's the problem. Mm. Josh Davey bowled really well up front for the Scots, and the Scots bowling generally on what turned out to be the first morning of the first game was absolutely on the spot. The seamers bowled really, really well to get the Dutch 35 for 5. And then van der Merwe and Sailor gradually started to turn the game around. Then the rain came after 23 overs, and we had to wait until the second day to continue the innings. They managed to get another 20 overs in, and it was a record-breaking six-wicket partnership, which really showed that, in conditions that weren't easy, if you batted properly, you could make runs.
And obviously, Sailor sort of better known for his bowling, which seems to be coming on a lot as a batsman these days as well.
Yeah, he's playing as a batsman, in fact. Because there are other spinners in the side, left-arm spinners, as it happens, he's bowling a lot less. And in club cricket as well, his batting has really come on. And he's now being played basically as a middle-order batsman who can bowl if needed. And he doubled his highest List A score in that innings of 68. And really, yeah, he scored faster than Von der Merwe. And he certainly didn't look like a junior partner in the partnership.
Obviously, that the rest of that game was washed out, and then the entirety of the second game was washed out. It's been a bit of a bugbear of mine for since the World Cricket League Championship started in the last one, that in a tournament the last 2.5 years, there's no sort of proviso for rescheduling these matches. Do you think that's something that should change in the future?
Yeah, I think it would be difficult, to be honest. The scheduling is difficult enough as it is. The ICC give countries, what is it, a 3-month window to find a date for the game. It wasn't easy to find a date for these games because the Scots wanted to have their county players available and had a strong preference for playing in September. And I think the Dutch preference was for playing in August. Mm-hmm. So I think scheduling would be an issue. And it's also partly got to do, I think, with the way in which the World Cricket League Championship has evolved, because it started out as just a couple of one-day matches played on the back of the Intercontinental Cup, which was the reason for bringing the teams together each time. And then at some point it was decided by the ICC that this would become a proper one-day competition and linked to the qualifying process such as it is for the World Cup. So the format of 2 games per round between each pair of countries was something that came out of an arrangement which wasn't really a competition at all. Mm-hmm. And I think the various changes which have taken place, including extending the game into the second day rather than just playing a different game on the reserve day, I think all of that has to do with the ICC trying to find a format which works. And to be honest, I don't think they've found it yet.
We could say that about so many things.
Indeed we could.
Yes. We'll move on now to the sort of Dutch year in general. I think safe to say it's been quite a good year for Dutch cricket. Promotion from World Cricket League Division 2 and then qualifying for the World 2020 again. There's been a few downs as well as the ups. So what's your overall take on the year for the Netherlands?
Yeah, I think you could say back on course in a way, because now where we are now, you can say that New Zealand, where the Dutch missed out on qualifying for the World Cup, was a glitch rather than, as some people wanted to interpret it at the time, a sign that the skids were under the side. They've come back extremely well, I think. And as you say, winning World Cricket League 2 in order to cement a place in the I-Cup and World Cricket League Championship, and then reaching the final, which couldn't be played for weather reasons, of the T20 qualifier. And, of course, also the performances in the last World T20, mm-hmm. which came after New Zealand, and where they beat Ireland in an extraordinary game and then went on to beat England. I think that's the pattern, and the New Zealand experience can increasingly be seen as a kind of blip on that overall shape of the way things are.
And we seem to be seeing now a sort of core of young Dutch-produced players coming through into the side as well. Netherlands often been criticised for relying on players of Dutch heritage in the past, but that seems to be changing a little now.
A little, primarily with the bowlers. Mm-hmm. I mean, King Maher and Van Meegeren are the obvious examples of bowlers who bowl with genuine pace and are able to cause problems to quite a lot of associates, batsmen. They've come through. We don't see it in the batting. And if you look at the domestic competition as well, it's clear that younger Dutch-produced players are able to compete with the overseas professionals and other more experienced players in bowling, but much less well in batting. And Rahil Ahmed, who's probably the most prominent one, still clearly is a work in progress, didn't have a good Intercontinental Cup match where he was twice out cheaply. But that's the first time he's ever played a multi-day game. So structurally, if we're looking at the overall structures, then the absence of multi-day cricket is clearly one of the problems that we have. It's also significant, I think, that Van Meekeren and Kingmore were members of a group who spent a winter in New Zealand in an academy. And Van Meekeren actually went back and had a second winter in New Zealand playing club cricket in Nelson. So that is undoubtedly a way forward, but it's worked much more for the bowlers than the batsmen. James Craddis, for example, was one of the batsmen who also went on that trip, and he hasn't come through in nearly the same way that the bowlers have.
Turning now to the Dutch women's side, obviously they played in the county competitions in England this year. Just looking at the results, they've sort of won as many games as they've lost. But it's looking like with a new structure for women's cricket in England that the Netherlands and Scotland and Ireland are going to be sort of left out in the cold. How big a blow is that to Dutch women's cricket?
Yeah, it's very, very disappointing. I was responsible for women's cricket when I was on the KNCB board, and it did come as a major blow. We've had a good season. The women have had a good season, finishing mid-table in Division 2 of the T20 competition in England and in mid-table in Division 3 of the 50-over competition. So it's particularly disappointing that Scotland, Ireland and the Netherlands, all of whom have done well in the county competitions, are now being squeezed out. But with the regionalisation of domestic women's cricket in England, we haven't entirely ruled out the possibility, and I say we, I mean Dutch cricket in general, since I'm no longer on the board, we have not ruled out the possibility of maybe developing a relationship with the southeast region in such a way that there would still be some county cricket. We have a very young side. One of the really pleasing things about how well the girls have done this year is that it's a very, very young side. Half the side are teenagers. And it's a side which is learning very fast. Players like Stera Callis have made runs against the counties. So the younger players are coming through. They'll have a really tough test in Thailand in November, December, when they play in the World T20 qualifier. But that will also be a huge learning experience for them, playing in conditions which most of them have never encountered before.
And obviously, looking ahead to that Women's 2020 qualifier, Netherlands literally just missed out last time. They lost the third place playoff by 2 runs. How confident are they of perhaps going one better and actually qualifying this time?
Well, obviously, that would be great. It's a much less experienced side. It's a much younger side. So I think in some ways the task will be tougher. They kick off against Ireland, which is a game with huge amounts of history, of course. And indeed Ireland were the opponents in that game, which cost them not only qualification but also ODI status last time. So that's a huge game. But then they play Zimbabwe and China. And with two going through, they need to win at least two of the three games. In order to make it through to the semi-final stage.
Looking ahead sort of briefly to next year, obviously the Netherlands have the World 2020. Can they get through to the actual tournament this time, as I suppose we should call it? Really, the first round is just another qualifier.
Yep. Can they make it through? Why not? They did last time. Mm-hmm. And the side is more experienced now. We don't, of course, know what the squad will look like, but Fonda Meerwes' arrival has made a difference to the overall balance of the side. And with the younger bowlers coming through, for example, the side is not, I think, weaker. And it showed in Scotland and Ireland that it's not weaker than it was 18 months, 2 years ago.
In terms of Van der Merwe, obviously he's signed a deal, I think, with Somerset next year. Do you think that's going to affect his availability for the Dutch side?
Well, we know how these things work with players, with contracts, with counties. We've seen it with Tom Cooper as well. And not only with counties, also with Southern Hemisphere first class states or franchises. So, I'm not involved in that. One would have to keep one's fingers crossed and hope that he would at least be available for the World T20. I think that seems pretty likely. Just, you know, looking at it from outside, that seems to me pretty likely. Whether he'll be available for anything during the northern summer, during the county season, on the evidence of other players, is much less likely, I would have thought.
Do you think this is a concern? That, you know, there are these mandatory release rules, but they don't seem to be particularly effective. That, you know, the integrity of the competitions is being sort of lessened?
At times, I think that's probably true, yes. But I think there are a lot of other factors involved as well. But yes, we know that whatever the rules may say, players' careers are at stake, and it's very easy for a first-class county or a first-class state or a first-class franchise to say, yeah, well, yeah, of course, you can go. But if you push us to that point, then, you know, we'll be looking again at your contract. This could have long-term career implications. Think very carefully. And that has been a factor in the past, we know, and not only for the Dutch, but also for Ireland and I think maybe Scotland, that I don't know. But we've seen it very clearly with Ireland in the past. So, it's one of the many areas of concern. I completely agree.
As for the Dutch domestic setup, we know about the top classer and whatnot. There's also the thing that's been sitting on top of it now, the series of matches between the North Holland Hurricanes and South Holland Seafarers. Is that going to continue?
As far as I know, it's going to continue. Of course, it involves Scotland as well. It's the North Sea Pro Series, and it involves the Northern Hurricanes and the Southern Seafarers. We tend to leave the Holland bit out these days because not all the players, at least not all the players who potentially could play, actually live in the two Holland provinces, but live in other parts of the Netherlands. So they're Northern and Southern, and the Scots are Eastern and Western. And what's interesting about that is not just that that competition has now had two seasons, only T20 this year internationally because of the World T20. They decided to focus on the T20. But also here, we now have young Seafarers, young Hurricanes, for the sort of under 17 to under 20, 21 age group, and mini Hurricanes, mini Seafarers. So there's a level of cricket for youth players above club cricket, between club cricket and the national selections and their various age groups, which hopefully will provide a bridge and indeed help to provide that development of young players that we were talking about, which is very important and which has been, I think, sadly lacking in the Dutch system for the past 10, 12 years.
And just ask about the Dutch youth setup. The under-19s played a tournament this year which didn't exactly go to plan.
No. No, that is true, and I think it's fair to say that the performances, with some exceptions, the performances overall in European championships over the past few years have not been great. It is an area of concern, absolutely, for everybody, and it's also a subject of considerable criticism internally within the Netherlands, that the youth program doesn't produce better results and doesn't produce more players who can make that huge leap to international cricket. I think often people underestimate just how big the step is from playing club cricket or even youth representative cricket to the international scene. But the fact is that both Scotland and Ireland have been more successful in that regard than we have. And Jersey and Guernsey, of course, are breathing down our necks.
Well, that just about wraps everything up. So thanks for coming on the show, and look forward to having you on again sometime in the future.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
There's one more tournament that's being played. It started today. It was mentioned by Tim Cutler in our interview with him in the last episode, the East Asia Cup. Somewhat important tournament for a few of these women's sides, and not a lot of cricket available to the women's sides, and good preparation, particularly for China, leading up to the World 2020 qualifiers.
Yes, certainly, and they'd be Hong Kong on the opening day, and the other game, Japan beat South Korea. Was it good to see South Korea still playing? You know, there was a bit of a worry that that women's side of the Asian Games last year was going to be just a one-off, but obviously not. Obviously, the Cricket Association there, you know, quite keen to, you know, carry on women's cricket there, and, you know, good to see them getting a game, even if they did lose. But I think, you know, in general, these tournaments, as we keep saying, are important, and you know, long may they continue. Hong Kong seems to be very proactive in arranging these tournaments. There's a, I think there's a few on the slate for the sort of next year or so. So, you know, they may not have the Hong Kong Sixes anymore, but they're obviously still, you know, busy arranging various matches for their national teams, both the men's and the women's team. So, you know, it's great to see, you know, an associate being so proactive.
Yeah, and I think particularly for the women's in that area, because as we've noted, that women's teams in East Asia have tended to precede the men's teams in doing well. So this type of tournament, this producing this type of rivalry between four teams that are pretty closely matched, hopefully in the future, if they continue to play this, they could get Thailand involved as well, could build up a really interesting structure.
Yeah, and you know, you can always make the argument that the East Asian women's sides in the East Asia Pacific region could probably actually be put in with the Asian sides instead of being with the Pacific sides, and you'd probably get some more interest in cricket there. And I think this tournament may just show that.
There was one piece of news, Andrew, that was that the Asian Cricket Council, what's left of it, is still organising the Asia Cup, and pleasingly, they'll include an associate team, and even more pleasingly, it'll be not a by selection as it was last time, but in fact a qualifying tournament will be played in November between the four T20 international status sides.
This is a very welcome development. You know, Asian Cricket Council certainly is what it once was, but it's absolutely fantastic to see them arrange a qualifier for will be the first ever 2020 Asia Cup, and obviously, as we say, the four T20I sides, you know, get the chance to play in that qualifier, and you know, for Oman, obviously, you know, they get to play some high quality 2020 cricket ahead of their appearance in the World 2020 qualifier, which they've not necessarily had the chance before. And obviously, you know, Hong Kong, UAE, and Afghanistan will use it as preparation as well. And I think the Asia Cup itself is scheduled for just before the World 2020, so whichever associate, you know, qualifies for, he's going to have some excellent preparation for that World 2020 playing against, you know, the four Asian full members. So, a good opportunity for, you know, whoever wins this tournament, and delighted to see it taking place.
That's it. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks for us, as always.